Jane, we're starting the interview, and this is an interview with Jane Foster as part of the Pioneers of the Fringe project. The interview was recorded on Wednesday, the 4th of April 2012 at Outer Liverpool Community Services, 264 Edmondson Avenue, Austral, and the interviewer is Sue Bowden. So, Jane, I'm going to ask you those very basic questions to give me your full name and your date of birth and your place of birth.
My full name is Jane Foster. I was born prior to World War II in a little village called Gilsland in the north of England, on the border of England and Scotland. My mother's was Constance Ralph, was her maiden name, and she was born...
You can tell me where she was born.
She was born in the north of England, near Gretna Green, on the border of England and Scotland. The name forsakes me there.
And do you know her date of birth?
She was born on the 25th of October, 1915.
And what about your father's full name?
My father's full name was Henry Elliott, and he was born in the city of Carlisle in Cumberland. And he was born on the 21st of January, 1913.
Thank you. So that gives us a bit of background that you actually must have come to Australia. So let's spend a little bit of time talking about your early days, your growing up, where you grew up and where you went to school. And what are your memories of those places?
Well, my younger days was in England, and I can remember quite well when I first got my tricycle, and I loved my tricycle. I was 4 years of age, and my father walked all the way home with me, and that was 30 miles. And it was a great joy to get a tricycle because everywhere we went was either by foot without my wooden clogs on or by horse. So I've had horses all my life, so starting from a pony. And I'm left-handed, and when I first started school, I got the cat of nine tails across my hand because you were to use your right hand, and I was totally left-handed. Everything I do was knitting, sewing, everything left-handed. I lost my speech, and my parents weren't from a wealthy family. Both my parents were the youngest of their own families. But they actually took the Department of Education to court over it, and they won. Everyone said you cannot fight the government. They won. I had to learn to speak all over again. Instead of the nearest school being 8 miles away, used to have to travel 16 miles to get to my new school. And the new school was a school where you started, and when you were 14, you left school, unless you were successful in your 11 plus to enter a high school. And I had already lost a year with schooling by having to learn to talk again. I was determined that I was going to pass that 11 plus. Even though I loved my little school, I just wanted to achieve something in life. And I did pass my 11 plus, and that probably caused joy for my parents, but also when I reflect back, very costly, because we had to have school uniform. I used to ride my pony or my bicycle then to the nearest bus, which was 8 miles away. I used to get a bus into Carlisle, our major city, then get another bus out to Rickaby, and I went to an exclusive high school. I actually wanted to get into a scholarship to get into it. A beautiful school called Eden School. And so it was 3 bus journeys, and I have fond memories of getting into the latter part of my education at the high school, when I had a very heavy school case, also a school bag and all these files and all my homework. And I used to go and do research at Tully House, which was our museum in Carlisle, then get the bus from Carlisle to Wetherill, and then cycle or have the horse to get back to a place called Wetherill Shields. And then it was homework time and then back to school. So I often wonder, how did I ever do it? When you hear the younger generation now complain about homework, etc., my parents also encouraged me to be involved in things. So I joined St. John's Ambulance when I was actually 6 years of age. My uncle was very high up in St. John's Ambulance, and it was a thrill to stay on a Tuesday night with my aunt and uncle in Carlisle in their home. And so I was involved in St. John's Ambulance from when I was 6. I then progressed through the ranks in St. John's Ambulance and became a superintendent and had quite a number of divisions, mixed divisions, boys' divisions, girls' divisions. I also joined the Girl Guides, and that was my parents showed great interest in it. My brother came along. I'm probably now going back. My brother is quite a lot younger than myself. He was actually born on the 28th of April, 1948. And my mother, at that time, I did not realise that she must have had a very difficult time giving birth. I actually remember the midwife coming out, and we had open fire with the black grates and the kettle that was always hanging over, getting the hot water and the towels and whatever. But I spent the first 3 years of my brother's life with one of my aunties, and he also was there. He actually took off, and he never crawled. He went on his bottom, and they had this huge river at the bottom of their property. And my auntie Nan and Uncle Bill and my cousins, they just could not find my brother Derek. And he had, on his bottom, with one leg underneath, had managed to go over this narrow bridge, and we found him in what in Australia we call a paddock. So that's another memory that I have. And also, while I was there, I remember being locked in the big farm barn because I did not like butter, and everything was during the war. We were lucky. They used to trade our coupons. My father used to trade our meat coupons and our dairy food coupons for what we call in Australia lollies, because we had all this on my auntie and uncle's farm. So if you didn't finish off your meal, it came out for the next meal and the next meal and the next meal. But I didn't like the butter and I didn't like the custard, so I was put in this huge barn. And I now wonder, how did I ever get out of that barn? Because it had huge doors, but I did, I got out of it. And there were happy memories there. And years later, when I reflect back, how cruel I must have been to my mum, because when we got back home, when my brother was 3 years of age and my mum was well enough to look after us again, I cried. I was homesick. I want to go back home to Auntie Nan. So those are some of my childhood memories.
So what we've got is a picture of you being a great joiner. You know, you were joining the St. John's and the Girl Guides, and you were driven to achieve at school. You finished school at Eden, at the Eden School.
Yes.
And you got your 11 plus. Oh, no, it's not.
No, 11 plus is from primary to high school.
And so then,
you do all levels and then A levels. Mm. Yeah, A levels is equal to the high school certificate.
So you get to that point.
Yes.
And then what's the story? What happens then?
I got a job at a solicitor's office, and I was a draftsman, plus you started as a junior, so you had this huge switchboard with all these plugs, and Masons, Clutterbuck and Clutterbuck, they were called. And I think now, if young ones now had to do what was done then by young trainees, they would just think they were being hard done by. As I was very good with maths, and I didn't think I was very good at drawing, but I became a draftsman there, as well as being a legal secretary. I got paid 5 shillings a week. That was my pay. And I thought I was in heaven with 5 shillings a week.
Can you remember what year that might have been?
In the 50s.
Yeah. Yeah. Early and 50s?
Yeah. 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 And so that's when I got glasses, when I first got glasses, way back then. And then my eyes came a little bit better, and I didn't have glasses until probably in the... I had glasses when my husband met me in the 60s, and then again in the 70s, and then that's been continual since then. From there, I went to a factory that made cellophane paper closer to my home. We had actually moved from Wetherill Shields to Rossler, it was called. So when we come to Rossmore, it was Rossler, at a crossroads there. And our home had the blacksmith shop at the end, but my father wasn't a blacksmith. We kept the blacksmith on. And so I went and joined Ray Fern, which made cellophane paper. And a lot of it came to Australia. So... And I became a laboratory technician. And believe it or not, all these years later, I wake up with anxiety attacks saying, yes, yes, I'm getting the results, I'm getting the results, because it was thousands of pounds going through these machines. And if the substance wasn't correct, there's all kinds of different cellophane paper. And I rose up in Redfern to be in charge of the research, the development part of the laboratory there. That's where I met my husband. He was transferred up from St. Helens, and I was only lady car driver in those days, and I used to have to pass the research and development block to go to the car park, and little did I know he kept watching me going to, and in my lunchtime, I never really got my lunch because my father wasn't mechanical. I was the first one to purchase a car in my family, and so I had to do things myself. I used to have my engines reconditioned and put the pistons. I just don't know how I did it, but I did. And so the men used to come and say, oh, there's something wrong with my car. Can you find... So back I would go to the tool shop and get tools from there and fix the men's cars during my lunch break. I also rode a 500cc motorbike, and my mum used to say to me, please, I beg of you, do not go out on that bike when it was windy. And the 500cc bike in the 1950s were very heavy compared to them now. And I look at the modern ones and I think, how did I ever ride a motorbike?
So you had a car and a bike.
I had the bike first of all, and then I purchased the car. and so I used to have to fix it at first. But when my husband actually saw me, I actually had my brand new Morris 1100 by then. I'd saved up enough money to buy a brand new car. And I was heavily involved, like I said before, in St. John's Ambulance, Girl Guides. I had quite a number of Girl Guide companies and St. John's Ambulance divisions when I first met my husband. And it was a Girl Guide night, and we were having a fancy dress party, and thank goodness my father never ever saw any photographs of how the staff dressed me up. It was Batman and Robin, and I was the lady that was the cat. And it was when thick tights came out, so I had these black tights on. They did up my glasses with like a cat and whiskers on it. I had a long tail, and you would have said it was... I was exposing myself to the other sex. My father would say he would have been absolutely disgusted, and I was afraid. And I was well in my 20s at that age. My father always said, "You do not have anything to do with boys until 21. You are a baby until you're 21." And he used to tell people. And they used to think I was a baby. And when I was 21, I wasn't really interested in boys at all, so it didn't worry me. But my husband saw me going past all dressed up. Next morning, he rang on the internal phone, and someone said to me, "That new manager wants to talk to you." And I go, "Me?" So he said to me, "I would really like to take you out. Could I take you out on Saturday night?" And I said, "Oh, I'm very sorry. I have this on." Anyways, after 3 weeks, I thought, I'm starting to feel sorry for this man, you know. He's so persistent. And he was in digs, and he had a motorbike. Never allowed me on the back of his motorbike, mind you. But I was the one with the car. I had the control. So in the end, I said to him, "Well, if you really would like my company and you're feeling homesick," because he lived at St. Helens, I said, "I have a big St. John's Ambulance parade. Lady Mountbatten's coming, so I have to be there and whatever. But I'll be quite happy to come pick you up, and it'll be a nice drive out to Keswick in the Lake District. So he did that, and then he rings me on the Monday morning and said, may I have your company again on Saturday? And I said, well, I've got this on. So this went on for quite some time. Then it was, Wickton was like Peyton Place. Everyone knew what was really going on, and Sunsa was having an affair with this one and whatever, and children born out of wedlock, whatever. And so I used to take some of the ladies up shopping in the car, and I would pass my husband, who wasn't my husband then, walking back down, they'd go, oh, isn't he gorgeous? He was thin in those days. Isn't he gorgeous? You know, and he's single, and, you know, he's out at the farm there. And so I just keep on driving and think. And then he used to buy me Black Magic chocolate, and I didn't like some centres in these chocolates. So my father liked my husband because I used to take the chocolates home and my father would eat them. So they were never opened up. And we went to see the men in the flying machines. And at work on the Monday morning, someone said to me, oh, was the chocolates good? And I said, I beg your pardon, the chocolates. And I go, what chocolates? They said, we heard the rustling of the paper. And I said, me with chocolates? You know, I don't like chocolates. And they said, we saw you with that new manager. So it took 6 months before anyone picked up on it. So I think we did pretty well in not saying so. The men in the flying machine movie gave it all the way, so really, yeah. So, and my wedding was fantastic. My mother had organised one of my Girl Guide companies to be the guide of honour for, so it was really...
And what year was that?
1967 I got married, yes. On the 3rd of June, 1967. My husband always furthered his education. He's got degrees in all kinds of things that wasn't relevant to his job. He was just educational-minded. And so we went to Windermere, which is in the Lake District, for our honeymoon. And, you know, nobody picked it up because he was busy studying. We got married on the 3rd of June, and he had a major exam on the 6th of June, which was his birthday. And I've got a beautiful Clydesdale Royal Dalton horse, so that our memory of my honeymoon there. So, yes, I got married late in life. Most of my friends were married around about when they were 19, 20, 21, 22. When I got to about 28, they said, you're going to end up being an old maid. But, of course, I didn't. And then after my husband and I got married, I keep saying, but my daughter keeps correcting me. I would say the worst 2 years of my life was the two years prior to my husband being transferred here to Australia. But my daughter was actually born at the end of that 2 years, and we lived at Slough. And it was when the jumbo jets were first introduced, and they used to come over the roof, and I see it now here in Sydney, but, oh, it used to shake the house, and I think that would be hit the roof. But there was another good thing about it was a townhouse, and I'd always lived in the country, and to be in on the outskirts of London. And we were 3 kilometres, which was 7 miles, as the plane flew over to Heathrow. And but out of the upstairs bedroom at the rear, we looked over to Windsor Castle, and a lot of people would go and wave at Buckingham Palace, not realising the Queen's standard wasn't up there. She was at Windsor most of the time. And so we were really the Queen's neighbours. Our local papers that we get, the free local papers that we get here in Australia, the one at Slough, it used to be not Her Majesty's, or it used to be, or Lizard the Gymkhana, and there she is in the gum boots and whatever. And Princess Anne, it would be headlines, how she was swearing anyway. So I wish I had brought some of those newspapers with me, because people don't think they really believe that when they're over around Windsor, they're just treated like anybody else, and you really don't see the bodyguards. Mm. And my daughter was actually born at the Royal Canadian Memorial Hospital at Maidenhead, which is in Royal Berkshire. So we lived in Buckinghamshire. So, and then for quite a number of years,
Who did your husband work for then?
Well, it was Rayfern, and then he worked for British SIDAC, which took over Rayfern. And because there was a lot of imports here to Australia, they wanted to set up laboratories over here to test the paper when it was coming into here, because there was a lot of complaints. And so he was transferred here. We're not 10-pounders. And the firm really didn't pay for very much, because my brother came here in the 60s, because it was pound shillings and pence when he came. He came with the Big Brother movement and was stationed at what is now Fairfield Farm. And he would write us letters and say, oh, we're way out in the country. And then he was transferred further down. He's done very well in life from that. But because he actually was in Victoria, and the British SIDAC had opened up laboratories at Moorebank here in Sydney, and at Moorabbin in Melbourne. And because my brother was already here, they asked him to sponsor us, meaning provide accommodation. So we arrived at Tullamarine Airport. And
what year was that?
1971. It was the 21st of March. We arrived on my daughter's first birthday. And
how did you arrive? You arrived by plane.
Yes.
Stopping London.
I can't honestly remember where we stopped coming over, because
we had a one-year-old baby. That'd probably be distracting.
Well, we were ferried off the plane into, because there was war in the Middle East, but we actually flew over. And I remember vividly the people all dressed up with their Middle Eastern outfits on. And we obviously had to stop for refueling, but we were ferried into the lounge and we were told not to speak to anyone at all, and then we were ferried back onto. So it was a 24-hour flight. Mm. So, and Qantas was very good to us with the baby. They bring us these disposable nappies that I'd never even seen him alive before. We packed everything up in wooden chests to come over here. And when our property arrived at Port Melbourne, we went to get it, opened up those wooden chests, and there was very little in. There was wedding presents that we had never even used, and one of my aunts married into a very rich family, and so there was very expensive dinner set, tea set, and that was all gone. And Lloyd's of London said they couldn't cover it because everything was intact when it left England. How would they know? It was we packed it up and then it went to wherever. And the insurance company in Australia, because we'd taken out insurance, said, well, they couldn't pay out because how did they know it was taken when it arrived in Australia? So we really started from what we arrived in, in actual fact, everything we bought was from St. Vinny's or somewhere like that, and that lasted us for over 30 years. So all these young ones that go out and they want the best things, whatever. So
you landed at Tullamarine,
yes,
and went to Moorabbin, or went to your brother?
My brother never came down because he was at Finlay. My mother had come out for his 21st birthday, and she planned to stay on for a couple of years. Well, when I think back, if I lost my son on his 17th birthday, I think I would be absolutely devastated. She never forgave my father for signing the papers for him to come out.
And was your father alive?
Yes.
So
he was still in England.
Yeah.
And we thought he would never come out because he was a coach driver in the end. When I was first born, he was a fireman on the Royal Scot train. And then he became a milkman with the horse and cart delivering the milk from the farms. And then he became a coach driver. And if he went from Carlisle to Newcastle on Tyne, which was the other side of England, on the border there of England and Scotland, it was 65 miles. He used to get homesick. And then when he drove down to London, he didn't mind driving down to London, but he always was homesick. And we thought, when we moved out here, he will never come out here, and Mum would go back. But once we arrived, she thought, well, what do I do? Do I go? He actually did come out. He came out. Never told my husband's family or my father that I actually was pregnant with my son, who was born on the 30th of December 1971. So my father emigrated out here on the 4th of May 1972. And
that was to Melbourne, because you were still
No, we're up here in Sydney.
So that didn't take very long.
No, it didn't. What happened was that we were to really come to Sydney, spend 3 months at Moorbank, and the permanent laboratory where my husband was to be was at Moorabbin in Victoria, but it didn't work out that way, so we were 3 months Dan, well, actually it was 6 months, Dan, and he used to travel from Maribyrnong, which was, as you know, the other side of Melbourne, right over to Moorabbin. And, and the very first car we purchased here, we bought a Footscray in Melbourne, and it was a Wolseley. And so he used to travel every day. I was told that I would never be able to have children, probably because age-wise, if you had children, you know, in your late 30s and 40s. So now it's the in thing, isn't it? but I also had in the hereditary thing. So they said I'd never be able to have children. So when I conceived my daughter, we were absolutely overjoyed. And they said, well, it'll be very doubtful whether you'd have any more children. And I started vomiting the second time in my life. The first time was when I had my tonsils out, the age of 3. And going back to then, if you went into hospital, you usually came out in a wooden casket. That's what it was known as. My mother never had her tonsils out because she was the youngest of the family and they just didn't want to be losing her. So it was necessity that it seemed like that I had to have my tonsils out. And it was like a cattle yard when I think all those children on this bed and then you went and the guy. Anyway, so when I had my daughter, they said I wouldn't be able to have any more children. They were sure I wouldn't have any more children. And I said I vomited, and I thought, that I vomited. Anyways, didn't think anything about it. And in England, you have to be at least 12 weeks before you go to the doctor's thing. See whether you're pregnant or not. So I thought the same thing applied here in Australia. So I eventually went to the doctors and so he said, you're pregnant. How could I possibly be pregnant? Anyways, I cried. I did not want another child with 18 months difference. And so he was born. And he was 13 pounds, 11 ounces, but he was a twin, it turned out. There was no ultrasounds at 5 months when I was, and when I got trans, I was booked into Footscray, and my husband was moved up here, and I actually had my son in Crown Street, which isn't there anymore, because Liverpool, they said if anyone was going to be having miscarriages, they would have had it before now. And at 5 months pregnant, the doctor said, I think I can hear a second heartbeat. At 7 months pregnant, I was up here, and they said, just can hear one heartbeat, but don't worry, what happens is that the baby will be behind. But no one in... Even in 1971, stillborns, unless they were recognizable, there would be a funeral. So I often wonder what happened, and they would have been identical twins. And so they said all the nutrition went into my son. And
so what are your baby's name? Your daughter's name?
Is Sarah Jane.
And your son's
is
name?
Is Leslie Jason.
And we haven't heard your husband's name.
My husband is James Leslie.
Oh, okay.
And so the initials JL, we called my son Jason Leslie. Leslie is a foster, it goes to the eldest child of the eldest. Mm. And so my son is Leslie 13. In the foster family. So my husband said there is nothing more embarrassing when you get older and your father opens up your mail. Mm. So we changed it to Leslie Jason. when I used to go to the doctors or wherever with him, they'd say, oh, Leslie, I think, who are they talking about? Because he was called Jason at home. Then when he started school, there was that many Jasons, so they said, can we call him Leslie? Yes, but we always called him Jason up to he was probably 10, and you'd hear everyone saying about Leslie. So he started calling him Leslie. But to get his attention now, you just go, Jason, and he jumps.
So tell me, you moved, what year was it? It was about the early 70s, 72 by the sound of it.
We came up to here at the end of 71 because my son. Yeah. We came in July.
And where did they land you?
We came up here and...
Drove up?
We drove up. It was a very long journey because there was no freeways or anything. Yes, and I was pregnant, and we had a baby daughter. And we stopped off and stayed the night at Goulburn because we just could not make it to Sydney. We came up to Sydney, and at that time you could get rental accommodation. There was always something around. So I can't honestly remember where we got that first house, but we were only in it a week, and we purchased the house. What the real estate agent said, do you really want to go all that way out into the sticks? And it was a house, 5 acres, opposite Kookaburra Road, which is called Cooperfield or something Avenue now. So that was our very first...
And what suburb is that?
It was called Preston's, and then our mail was Roadside Mailbox 29 via Crossroads.
Yeah.
We were there, and I used to read my children's stories waiting for the school bus. Underneath the big tree, and that's all gone. Now, the day my husband brought my son and myself home, my mum came up
from
Crown Street. 2 days later, all this heavy machinery came up to the front of the property, and when we bought the property, we were told that the RTA had bought the front of the property for a road to widen the Hume Highway, as it was called then. It's called Cameron Valley Way now. And I remember going out and saying to them, take those things away. I have just brought my son home from hospital. He is only 7 days old. Come back later. 30 years later, they came back to start doing the road at the front. So, but they did come and do, when they were building the F5, they came and dug a lot of landfill out then, and then they filled it back up again because they had nowhere to take landfill at some time, so we used to get a lot of rubbish.
But tell me about your memories of, you know, those. What did you think you remember you saw when you arrived? You came up from Goulburn, you came to Western Sydney essentially, which at that point was out in the sticks.
Well, the house was, Liverpool was too crowded for me. But
you were looking for some space.
Well, I'd always been on space except 2 years prior to coming to Australia. My husband spent the war years with his mum in Glasgow because his father fought in Burma. And so he never went back to St. Helens until well after the war was finished, seemingly. And so when he first met me, and after we got engaged, my parents said, it is really silly that he is paying for what we call digs. There's your brother's bedroom, he can come and... So that's what he did, he came to...
So he was on the back into a place of space and...
And so space, and he loved the space, and so... And this is why, 2 years ago, when we put our property out at Rossmore on the market, the people, because we knew sub-development was coming through, we also... after 2 years of retirement of my husband, he didn't like retirement, so he said, I've applied for a job with the ATO, which was entirely different to what he had done during his working life. And I said to him, if you get that job, I will go and eat hay with the horses. So he applied in October. In the November, he hadn't heard anything. And I thought, he's getting so depressed. How can I say to him, you'll never get the job. You're past retirement age. Then John Howard decided, people didn't need to retire at 65, because when John Howard was 64, he was still Prime Minister. So then he got to the December and he got a letter to say they would like to give him an interview. He was on the short list of 102 people, and I thought, no way will he get this job. In the January, he got another letter to say, we need you to come in and do a written test, and you're down. We're down. We've culled it down to 12. And my daughter said to me, Mum, you better get ready to eat hay with the horses, because Dad always has to achieve 100%, and he would challenge people at the universities. If he got 99.9, he wanted to know where he went wrong so he could improve it. And they would say, we can't give anyone 100%. You have 100%. So anyways, my daughter said, Mum, he will get that job because he will just fly through. Because people were using calculators and everything, and it was mental arithmetic, English. When I first met him, he could speak and read 7 languages fluently. And so it was very handy when we went on the continent. He would talk away to people and then translate it back to me. So he did get the job, and so I went and got a handful of chaff and ate that, remembering from my childhood days of going eating chaff and corn and whatever. So I would never ever say that to him again, because it was not really pleasant. But I kept my word. And
so you're at Preston's and you've got 5 acres. Yes. And you've got 2 then, little children and your mother.
Yes. And oh, no. My mum was in Victoria, father came over, okay. And they were in Victoria. Then they moved up here to Sydney, in our little cottage on our property. But my mum pined for the Dandenongs, because coming from the Lake District, as we'd say, she really loved the Dandenongs, so they went down there, and then there was disagreement, so my father came back up here, and then I cared for him for 35 years, because he was never sick. I never remembered him sick. And then when he was in his late 60s, he had his first heart attack, and then just traumas. And he actually had dementia. But we used to say, he's turning like Grandma Elliot. He's forgetting his memory like Grandma Elliot. But now we know she obviously had dementia. And it turns out he actually had signs of dementia before he came to Australia, because he lost his pension. Campbelltown Hospital said he could never, I'd been caring for him. And then something that I feel very guilty about, but people say that I shouldn't. I actually went to a Pony Club state meeting and in Sydney. My father didn't sleep all that much, and he used to be up most of the night and sleep during the day. So I took the risk and I went to the meeting. Then I came from that meeting in town to our Outer Liverpool Community Service Management meeting, and my son rang and he said to me, "I've been searching for Grandpa, I found him." And I said, "Where is he?" "Stuck in the toilet." And he had been, and it was November the 30th, and it was one of our hottest days that we ever had. And so my son rang the ambulance, and I said, "Well, I'll come." And he said, "Well, is there there?" The metal hantel rail was, when I saw it afterwards, was bent. My father must have tried to get out, but it had sucked him in. And how long he'd been there, we do not know. The ambulance came out. They just did not know what they were going to do because they broke the toilet pan. And anyways, with my son and the two paramedics, they actually managed to get him out. And then he was in a coma. He was sent to Campbelltown Hospital. And when he was coming out of the coma, they said, "You will never be able to take him home. He is very high care now, and you'll need to put him into a nursing home. But he'll be lucky if he survives 3 days. He survived over 5 years. It broke my heart going to those places. Mm. And so I had this guilt feeling, and people would say, "You looked after him, you owed him nothing." And I said, "I should have never gone to that meeting. I should have never come here to the Oaks meeting." But anyways,
well, you've got...
He lost his pension, and I fought to get it back. And it turned out that there was some record in England that he may have been suffering from Alzheimer's, which is hereditary. So, yeah.
So what we've got is, I'm getting a feeling that we need to get to your beginning of an involvement in the community.
Yeah.
Not necessarily out of Liverpool community services, all of the things that you were involved with as a mother and a wife and a community person at Preston's. So how did that start?
That started...
Girl Guide still?
No. It started in May 1972 when my father was disgusted because we didn't have any horses, and I'd had horses.
So you've got 5 acres and no horses.
So he purchased the horse for his little granddaughter, and then we bought another horse, and then I got back into riding. And Ingleburn Pony Club, which is the oldest existing pony club in Australia, was opposite Hornsey Park, which was still called Via Crossroads. And
so I started there, very close.
We only had to walk down the road. And so that's where my community involvement started. They jumped at the idea that, I was a horse rider and I came from England and had a very good knowledge of things, horses from England and from instructing in England. So I became a pony club instructor very, very quickly. And then there was a split between polo cross. And polo cross, I don't know whether you're aware, it was invented by the founders of Ingleburn Pony Club. There was no such thing as polo cross. They invented it. They went to England, their second visit to England, Edward Hurst and his wife, and they picked up the polo sticks, and they'd been in France and saw lacrosse, and they thought, how can we adapt that to horses? So they actually invented polo cross. So Ingleburn Horse and Pony Club was the very first one to have polo cross.
Was there a polo movement out here then?
There was polo, but not polo cross.
No, and there was a polo club.
Oh yes, it was polo clubs. So they invented that long before I came. That was 1937 they invented polo cross. And then they started another club up so there could be competitions down in the Southern Highlands. So there was then a split between when I joined Ingleburn Horse and Pony Club. The pony clubbers had to be really the servants to the polo cross players. They used to have to go and pick up the balls. So our chief instructor there had enough, and we had mediation with the polo cross side because it ended up two different divisions. And we're the only pony club to hit the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald. We were, because Justice Street, as he was then, was the judge, and he awarded the pony club side. We won the case, not polo cross, but the land had to be sold because we could not afford the rates, and polo cross still wanted to use that field, and then they had no money and they went to appeal and they couldn't take it any further because they hadn't any money. The rates was getting larger and larger, so we actually, the Pony Club, helped pay those rates, and then the ground had to be sold.
And so this is Liverpool Council rates?
This was Liverpool Council rates. This was in the court case was finalised in 1974. It started in October 1972. When the split, so we were very new to the Pony Club then. We just started because Leslie was just a baby, and so I used to go take my baby son and my she wasn't a toddler then, down into Sydney to the courts, and anyways, the land was sold, and so we used to. I'm an instructor.
Yeah.
So we used to ride along the Hume Highway, which is Camberley Way, and with my daughter to go down to Ingleburn because we got land for the Pony Club down there. And I think, how did I ever do it? But anyways, did it. When my daughter started preschool, which was the very first one at Ingleburn, Methodist Church then. They had started what we call now a long day care. And I was told that it would be good if my daughter actually went to a preschool. Because while I was carrying my daughter, I actually was in hospital a long time on my back. Laying on my back. But then when I was pregnant with my son and was came up to Crossroads, Prestons, I knew that the hospital and the doctors would want me to go into hospital, and I couldn't do that because there was no one to look after my daughter.
Mm.
And because my mum had full-time employment. So I promised to stay in bed. I knew it was my life was on the line and also my baby's life. So my daughter was very good. I would read to her. She would sit on on the bed, and I would read to her and I would play games with her, and she's very good at craft now. And so it's probably from those early years, sewing and knitting. And then when her father came home, when my husband came home, he would take her outside and she'd get the fresh air and play and whatever, whatever. And so when we started her at preschool, it was May 1974, she was a foundation member child, they had Girls Brigade, and the lady who ran the Girls Brigade was the school principal at Leppington, and that's the school that my children came to, Leppington. So I actually met Betty Allen before my daughter went to Leppington School. So I got involved in different activities, helped as a mum, fundraising, and whatever, and I used to help at the preschool and
Girls Brigade.
And then that's how I got involved in Girls Brigade, because Betty Allen could see, or she used to say, leadership, and would train your daughter to become a little cadet. St. John's Ambulance was chasing after me because they'd heard about, but I never taught first aid here in Australia. I'd been joined for that. So that's how I started with involvement in the community. And then that enlarged when my daughter started school. So I was on the PNC. I used to go and do activities in the school. I was a canteen helper in late 1980s. I was the filling canteen supervisor because John Peck, who I think has already been interviewed by Therese, she actually suffered a heart attack. So I was the filling canteen supervisor.
And that's there, at Leppington Public School.
Yeah.
And how did you get to the school from Crossroads?
From Crossroads, I drove up. My children would get the school bus, and I would drive up in my little minivan. Yes, and so my son used to take my son with me to help at the school, and Pony Club was a big part of our lives. I would exercise horses for people, that bring them to the property, our property, or adjust them on our property with our horses. And just then at Leppington School, Betty Allen felt there was a need to have activities for children that were going into the high schools that lived in our isolated area. So we formed a committee called the Laugh Leppin Austral, Ross Moore and F out of Catherine Fields. And so we'd run activities.
So this is Life.
This is Laugh.
Yeah.
In a spare classroom at Leppington Public School, and from then we the parents with Betty Allen would run their activities for these children, and then we were fortunate enough to get a grant to get a youth worker there called Kelvin Chambers.
So what year was this?
1978, the year of the child.
Ah, and where was the grant? State or
it was
Liverpool
just,
Council?
I cannot remember. I think it was WASAS, if it was called WASAS. And it was for 6 months only. Then we were lucky enough to get it extended. And Kelvin,
so that was the beginning.
That
of
was
the
beginning.
Community development and support.
Yes,
you know.
And we purchased the bus, And then there was...
So this is the bus that we've got a photo of. I'll put it into the
No,
tab.
No, this was the last bus.
Okay.
Okay, it was a 22-seater Toyota Coaster bus, and it was blue and white because we purchased it from the Spastic Center at
Lambie Heights.
Yes. And so I was the driver of the bus because I, coming from England, New South Wales recognise your English driver licence, so I could actually drive a road train because I drove articulated lorries. But I must say, I did have, oh, you did a written test here in New South Wales, but I must say, I don't know whether I was one of the fortunate people or one of the not fortunate. Because we came to Melbourne, Victoria had different rules about English driver's license, so you actually had to have a test. So I had my driving test, my first one in Australia, at Sunshine Police Station on the outskirts of Footscray. And you went to the police station, the policeman came out, got into the vehicle, and off you went. So I actually can say that I have actually had a driving test in Australia. I have had many, actually, because driving a community bus, I wanted to make sure that carrying the lives of children with laugh, it was important to me that I try to do everything correctly. So the RTA used to say, why do you want us to do your driving test? You've been driving all these years. And I said, and I've forgotten how much it was in those days. I think it was about $25. And I said, I'm quite prepared to pay for it. And so one of the driving examiners used to give me the heebie-jeebies, but anyways, I used to think, right, I've got to be on my toes as if I've got the children in the bus. And then as time went on and joined other things, I still went to have a driving test because I ended up taking people of my age or older, and so I was taking parents and grandparents, so I wanted to assure the children of those people that I was right. So I actually had many tests, but I was the laugh driver. When Kelvin Chambers came, we had him go and do his tests to drive the bus, and but I was the main driver of it, and I looked after the bus. It had to be stationed on my property twice. And then we could see there was a need, and Liverpool Council, because Leppin School comes under Camden Council, so it wasn't Liverpool Council helped us with LARP because it's Camden Council. So with the help of Liverpool District Neighbourhood Centre, I don't believe it had actually that name then, but Jean Mills was the chairperson there for years and years and years. And with her management committee and with Betty Allen and the community, we and councillors, we involved the local MPs, state and federal, and council helped fund the magic bus. They called it the magic bus, and that was what is actually in the photos now, this the double-decker bus. And so that's how we started.
There was another magic bus, the magic yellow bus. I think it was.
It is, isn't
two
it?
Two magic buses in Sydney.
So with the magic bus name didn't last all that long.
And what was the organ? Was that the? That wasn't laughter.
No,
by then you'd set
no.
up another...
This is what it was. We were just called the Magic Bus, is now at Liverpool Community
yes.
Service.
Okay.
Then our name was changed to the Roaming Rainbow. So we called the new bus Roaming Rainbow Bus. That's the name that we've kept for many years. Our demountable building has the original sign on it that says Roaming Rainbow Bus. We ended up having to change the name, and I have a feeling it was in 1994, because the staff were inundated with phone calls, people wanting to book buses. They thought we were a bus company, not a community service. So we then took up the name of the LG area of Liverpool, which was Outer Liverpool. Mm. So we called ourselves Outer Liverpool Community Service. When Council LGA changed its name again to the Western Districts, we thought that doesn't sound good and all that. And we were a company. We're now an incorporated body. We became incorporated in the 1990s. I used to be very good at remembering all these dates that I can. But we went from being a company to an incorporated body.
So when we just started the Magic Bus, what was the why did you do that? Why did you actually have something that was mobile rather than a service that could have a base that people came to? Or
well, the children couldn't get here.
Yes,
and most of the children, as Betty Allen started off the laugh. Most of the children that came to the local schools came from farms. So they'd come to school, they would then have to go and work the farm. They used to work the farms before they came to school. And Betty Allen had this foresight that the older the parents got, and some of the children didn't really have the interest on the land, and so she had the foresight that a lot of these children may do very well in life, which they have done, a lot of them. And I think a lot is owed to Betty Allen. She was a very caring principal. She was at Leppington for over, I think, about 25 years. So that is why we originally purchased the bus. And then we could see we couldn't expand ourselves. So, as I said, with the help of Council and Liverpool District Neighbourhood Centre, we got this Magic Bus. And so the children couldn't get to us. It was school buses, but that's all there was. So we made arrangements, or did a lot of work before we actually got the Magic Bus, with schools in the area, through Betty Allen, of course, and with the Progress Associations, because we felt we would probably need a hall if we were able to get the children there. First of all, we weren't offered halls. Schools, Austral, Rossmore, Bringelly, Ludnam, Wallachia, Kemp's Creek, Badgery Creek. There's one missing, I've forgotten which one it was. The schools all said, yes, you can bring your bus one day a week, which we did. So it was not just for children in the end. We had women's group, we had craft, we had painting, we had pottery, and then stemming from that, long after the Magic Bus, were the Roaming Rainbows. The preschool that's on the grounds at Rossmore School out of what we now call out of Liverpool Community Service, actually started that play group. That it was started that long daycare, but it was only for activities after school for the children. And then we went to try and get a license and have it as a preschool. And it's now Salvation Army that we gave away quite a long, long time ago. We established the play group or long daycare in Austral School, all stemming from the, because we didn't really have room in the end on this double-decker bus. It was great at first because we ran the activities upstairs for the children and the ladies' groups, and downstairs we had the kitchen and we did cooking lessons and all kinds of things. But unfortunately, that double-decker bus died quite a number of times.
Who were the pioneers? Was there a committee? Who were you working with?
We formed a committee. Betty Allen wasn't on this magic bus in the end. When Therese had that activity display just recently at the Austral Bowling Club, there was quite a number of the people there that was actually on the committee.
On the planning committee.
There was a husband and wife.
Mostly parents.
It was parents through the schools, yes. And then the committee grew because we had people come and tutor children in English. Then we went to children needed help with homework, and that's when parents who were working in the cities would then come and pick up the children. And I say to the staff, our current staff now, we used to run these tutor classes, and you used to break your neck to get to Austral Progress to pay in the fee every day. What we used to get paid, it always had to, and Herbie Starr, who's his hall's named after, he used to stay up nothing for us so we'd make it to put the money in. When we still had the double-decker bus and it was parked here at Austral, Bruna Tremarchi, that you've got, she used to come up to the ladies' group because on the farms they were only seeing their children and their husbands. From all accounts, I think she had to work very hard. But we laugh about it now. Their property was long and narrow. And so she used to have gone Boots Wellingtons to work the land. She used to climb through the fence and hide her gum boots. And she used to have her Italian sandals. And she would walk up. She actually lives on Kelly Street, but the end of the property comes out onto 4th Avenue, so it wasn't really much of a walk when we got, and she'd come up to the bus. So we did a lot of things for her. I was a mum then. I was joined the groups, but I was also on the management committee. So
women, isolated women, really,
would come,
as well as the children.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
And so building those networks for them so they would.
Yes.
And language skills.
And then our staff would have contacts to get help for them and would have speakers coming out. As I say, that bus died and we got a tiny 12-seater, no, it wasn't 12-seater, 10-seater Hi-Es van.
What year was that, do you think?
I can tell you it's on this photo because I lived 1986.
Okay.
And that's when it broke down and died. And so with the help of Liverpool Council, we bought this little bus. And so we also had, it meant we had nowhere to run our activities except at schools. We were growing bigger by that time. We were applying for funding.
So you were getting funding from Liverpool, but you were looking Liverpool Council.
They helped start us with the bus, but everything was done voluntary. And so we would...
So what happened to Laugh had...
Laugh still continued for many years, and I'll tell you about what happened with Laugh shortly, because it all to do, and my involvement in this area. So we purchased this bus, so all the equipment, play group equipment, kindergarten, files, whatever, all had to go into this bus.
So having been in a double-decker bus.
Yes, so the seats came up. Yeah. So some of our staff now think just carrying our equipment up from the container into this hall and back and forward, they should have worked for us when we had that bus, because... And our staff in those days seemed to do things much quicker than what we do these days. But I'm much older now, so and I'm not staff. I'm a volunteer and part of the existing foundation member of it on the management committee. Any roles on the management committee. So we got that bus, and then we looked for a property where we could store things, and funding was for us to be mobile service. So even though we got a house on the corner of 5th and 4th Avenue, and an Italian gentleman called Mr. Camilleri, he said he would help the community, and instead of charging us $100 a week rent, he would charge us $80. So we paid $80 rent. The funding body did not cover rent. They still do not cover rent. So we had to do things to raise money to pay our rent. And
as well as run a bus.
Yes. And the management committee in the early days would run activities. We would run fetes, and we managed to get quite a lot of money to keep us going. But that money is actually dwindled now. We rely really to have paid staff. We have to secure government grants. And it's only it's reviewed every year, and it's very hard to take on staff who they're told straight away it depends on the funding, and the funding's for 12 months, but if we don't do the right thing in the contract, it can go after 3 months. So
there's no continuity.
Management sort of lives on their nerves whether you're going to get refunded or not.
And that's really 30 years of being on the edge.
But now there's no docks. It is now community builders. This is the trial year. They were expecting us to do more because people down at Bankstown, their office, the glass-fronted offices, they don't fully understand. The most populated area of us is here at Austral, and all this sees all this development's going to happen, but they want us to give service originally it was 172 square kilometres of the LG, Liverpool LG area. We're now down to 141 because West Hoxton and Milton Grange is old. So our office used to be, post box used to be at Hoxton Park. And that was the highly populated area. But as growth has come, we've come because there's still the need. These isolated people with ethnic backgrounds.
And children still as well.
Yes. And so, as I said, we got this little house, 3-bedroom it was, and it also had a garage to store things in. And Mr. Camilleri owned the Brick Veneer house also, that's slightly further down the road. And so he used to let us use his huge shed on that property to store things. So we didn't have this trouble of storing things on the bus anymore, just packing the bus when we went out to the different areas. Then this bus in 1986 became a little too small for what we needed to do. We needed to transport people. So with the help of council again, we purchased a 15-seater Toyota Hiace for Peter Warren, from Peter Warren in 1988. He only charged the cost price. We had ample, who used to give us diesel, and so our fuel used to be free, but not any longer. And so we got the new bus and we could have activities, and there are some photographs somewhere around here that was done. That photograph there is the front of the little house where the 3-bedroom house, and that's one of the women's group we must have been having.
So these photos we have on a digital, they've been photographed onto a stick.
Yes,
so
yes.
We'll put those onto the file.
Yes.
Very good photos of the original Roaming Rainbow and the Magic Bus. Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
And so,
and 1988 was quite a big year because by then you were beginning to win awards, weren't you? In the bicentennial year, did you get an award?
I did.
Yes.
That's
tell us about that.
Oh, this other in Canberra was 1991.
Oh.
But in 1988, we won awards for the area that we're in and for the work that we were still called the Roaming Rainbow Bus then, for the work that was done, mostly by volunteers, and so that was the award in 1988. Yeah, my own award was in 1991.
Well, while we're on that, maybe we should talk about your award. Tell us about that. What did you get in 1991?
Oh, well, in 1991, I have some photographs. The children of one of our Roaming Rainbows. Now, Roaming Rainbows name comes from the name of the bus, which was Roaming Rainbow Bus. But we used to take the women off their properties for a day out. And so they became known as the Roaming Rainbows because they were mixed nationality. That group still runs, the Roaming Rainbows, and
Under the auspices of
Outer Liverpool Community Service. They're all getting much older. Anyway, that Roma Jakobek, her granddaughters did homeschool. And for the bicentenary of Australia,
1988.
No, it wasn't the bicentenary. When they first broke away from England.
Federation,
that's it. The children nominated myself as to be one of the 5,000 figures that would stand on the lawns between New Parliament House and Old Parliament House in Canberra. And I knew nothing about it until there's a photograph there where I had to go to Roma's house and they took a photograph of me and the outline of a person. And it was covered with all my achievements. And that was sent down. So I'm one of the lucky ones of the 5,000 that stood. And because I'm a foster now, next to me on lawns was a foster too, a famous axeman. So, and there was a book published, and I've tried very hard to find that book, but I was starting to tell you a short while ago that we put our Rossmore property on the market, and the property next door to us took 6 years to sell. So we were looking forward, right? Probably in 6 years we will move. We need to start downsizing. And I would store everything for people. And little did we know that within 2 months there was a buyer and we had nowhere to go. We had not planned. We had to decide, are we going to take the money or not? If we don't take it, how long will it take to sell? Anyways, that buyer actually went overseas. He paid the deposit, he went overseas, and then he was going to, in 3 weeks after he got back, the real estate agent said, we'll sign all the paperwork. But that didn't happen. Turned out that when he came back, the real estate had got a new salesman. He had found this more modern, because we just had a fibro house, a much more modern house. And we had this huge shed in this place. So this next thing we knew, the deposit sign came off the sign, and we thought, oh, well, breathing space. And within 2 weeks of that coming down, we had somebody else came. And but they had to sell their two beautiful homes out on the subdivision at Catherine Fields. And so we had sort of breathing space. So we thought to find somewhere. And then by September, we still had not found anything.
And what were you looking for?
We were looking for not being in a crowded area, but probably just an acre, because my husband can't do the fencing and whatever. You'd never believe it. But, oh, God, we're on 485 acres now. I started driving around because we thought, well, maybe we just rent somewhere, but where are we going to put all this stuff? And I had to get people, come and get the things because we're selling the house and blah, blah, blah. And, oh, it was really traumatic, that move. It really was. And so I was driving around looking for places for sales signs and whatever. And I went out to the back of Kemp's Creek and back of Penrith, and people say, where do you live? And I go up on a huge hill. We're not Kemp's Creek, we're not Erskine Park, we're not St. Clair, we're not St. Mary's, we're not Penrith. Part of the property is actually Fairfield, a tiny little bit, because it backs onto Horsley Park. But we've come under Penrith Council now. And so we're right up on this huge hill. I'm driving past and I think, oh, what a beautiful house. It reminds me, like, back home, all those trees, even though they're not English trees. Wouldn't it be lovely to look there? And I pulled up, having a look, And you see down to Wollongong that way and the way, the Blue Mountains. I thought, oh, what a dream place. We'd never be able to afford this place. Anyways, I'm driving around. So then I took my husband and son and said, wouldn't it be lovely? You know, how about round here? And we fell in love with this house. Anyways, I picked up courage. I saw this man outside and whatever, and doing some work. And I said to him, oh, you've got a beautiful house here. It's just so beautiful. And he said, well, I'm the brother of the owner, and my sister's got MS, and it's so bad now that she's actually in a nursing home. And he said, we're going to have problems because her family, and so it's been decided that we're going to sell the property. That's why I'm here. I'm painting and whatever. And I said, oh, isn't that lovely? You're selling the property. And I'm thinking, God, you know, it'd be several million dollars, this place. Anyways, it was never ever advertised that it was for sale. It was done privately, and they actually had a viewing. And my husband and I were the first ones to get there, and then all these people come. Because they were going to do it on a Saturday, and I go, oh, no, I've got a horse event on Saturday. Can't come on Saturday. So we understood they were doing this private viewing just for us on the Thursday night. So we're waiting. No, the estate, because it did go through estate agent. And all of a sudden, all these cars. And my husband said, that's it. And so he was going to get in the car. And I said to him, and the young family and these people that looked as if they had lots of money. And he said, we're going. I said, we're not going. We're going to wait. Because how can I say to the real estate agent, you put it on the Thursday and I'm not here. So anyways, we waited, and I'm saying to this young family, be careful, because I'd seen a brown snake. So we were all taken as a group, and the horse came up. And she's seeing the people running, and I'm patting it, whatever. And there's the cats and whatever. Anyways, the son came, and he opened up. He would not let the real estate agent open. He had the keys, so we had to wait for him coming. So my husband's complaining all the time, and I'm going, oh, look at that, an open fire. Oh, just like what I had back home. Oh, wouldn't that be lovely? Then the son said, oh, don't worry about the bees, he said. Well, he said, there was this huge pile of bees that just had them terminated or whatever. And so we're walking through, and I'm thinking, you know, we know, there's no way in the world we'll get this. So, anyways, we spoke to the son and spoke to his uncle, and off we went. So 2 weeks later, my husband said, oh, has the real estate agent contacted you? And I go, no. And he said, well, you know, it's very disappointing, but you better keep looking, because we're 2 weeks left before the contract was to be signed. So I rang the real estate agent and I said, have you got any other properties out that way for sale? And the girl said to me, oh, we didn't leave your number. We have no number. She said, we're so happy. The house is yours. And I go, what? How much? And so that place is worth millions. But they had just thought, this is it. They spoke to the mother. They spoke to... But there are conditions. We had to take on the horse. We had to take on was supposed to be the cat. And there was two cats. And keep up the garden. Then it's all in the sales agreement. And then if we sell it, even though they really have nothing to do with it, but we would say we will, because we'll get millions for it. But the rates are very low because it's still classed as farming. So
what's the address? No, not the address of the whole street, just the address of the suburb.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
You must have
the mail address is, you get mail that says Kemps Creek, you get mail that says Penrith. So we get mail...
What are the rates say?
Penrith. Okay. Says Penrith.
Now, I'm going to go back because I've got confused. Because I thought that you were living... You bought your 5 acres at Crossroads.
Yes.
And then you sold and moved
to Rossmore.
When
yes,
was that?
24 years ago. So that would be...
So in the 80s.
Yeah.
In the 80s you moved... You sold the Crossroads property with the horses and the ponies and your father.
Yes.
He was living with you then.
Oh, he had then moved to...
To
Hoxton Park.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you bought at Rossmore. Where
didn't buy there. We bought in Little Street, which is off Kelly Street.
In Austral.
Well, it's called Rossmore, but it's called Austral now. So we bought 5 acres out there. The Chook farm belonged to Hazlitt's. So we had what I would call a wood, but lots of trees and everything, but it was Hazlitt's property that joined us. Hazlitt sold that to Ingham's. Ingham's decided they were going to subdivide all that into 5 acre lots. So we ended up having neighbours. But then the airport was coming out to Badgers Creek, and when we looked, the flight path was right over our property. Okay, we're going to put it up for sale. So we sold there and we bought out at the back of Rossmore and Catherine Fields.
And when was that?
24 years ago actually moved there. So it was prior to... We were at the other property for 2 years before
that. So 87-ish, something like that.
So, yes, so we were up there.
And that's similar 5 acres?
Yeah.
With horses?
Yeah. Oh, actually, the Rossmore one, the last one was 6 acres, with our horses. And then my daughter moved out with her girlfriend, then she got married, and then her husband died 4 years ago. And so she lives in the built-up area. She lives at Mount Preacher, but she comes out and helps with my garden because we've realised the property is very big. My husband will never, ever be able to do what he used to do. He'll look after his bonsai. So with the help of my son and my daughter, the place looks very nice. And with our retired thoroughbred horse, and the horse we inherited on the property, and the kangaroos. That's what I loved about it. We've got kangaroos, we've got paper lace lizards in our roof. We kept in one side, and they come out and they sit on top of the big chimney catching the bees. So we actually have bees in our chimney, and...
Do you have honey? Do you do that?
The honey drops down onto the fire because we didn't... We got a fireplace, I can't put a fire on, and my brother came up and he's allergic to bees and whatever. But you have the fire on, the bees are still... They survive, and
the smoke
sends them out and they come back in again. So we've got... pet bees as well.
So now you've gone from the frying pan into the fire, with beautiful land to look after and the Outer Liverpool Community Services still happening in your life.
Yes.
And Pony Club still happening?
Yes, but not to the degree that it was several years ago, because I worked myself up in Pony Club to national level. And so when there's only 4 retired zone chief instructors in New South Wales, the newer zone chief instructors, the younger ones, they are in full-time employment and very difficult to do these courses at universities. And so as for retiree ones, we get called upon to, like people, others in other states, the A certificate is a national certificate. It's worldwide, really. And so we get called upon when those exams are held with the expertise. And once that become vets, etc., they don't have the administration side that you also need in these things. But I did it very quietly, and I traveled the state. It's now when I go to different places around New South Wales, I see more than the shore grounds or where we used to run the event, because you drive there, do your thing, come back out. Most people, grown-up children now, you bump into them, and I don't really, without riding gear on, it's very hard. It's like school children, but they remember me. But how are you, Mrs. Foster? In Pony Club, I got the nickname of Fossy. So now I just go, oh, Fossy's calling. But I've got a brand new name that people are calling me, and it stems from Outer Liverpool Community Service, our coordinator's granddaughter. I don't have any grandchildren, which means I don't have any great-grandchildren. So Tanya's grandchildren would be, her children, I would be really their grandmother. So Madison, the eldest granddaughter of Tanya, when she started to learn to talk, she would call me Zane. And then when she got a little bit older, she would hear her grandparents and her parents saying, oh, Jane's running around again, she never stops. That's what people say everywhere I go, I'm running, they say. So Madison calls me Running Jane, and to be surprised, I go shopping and they go, oh, hello, Running Jane, wherever I go, I'm Running Jane now. Oh, that woman from Alt. Yes, getting back to moving up to this new property, I did say, I'm sorry, I can't come every day, because instead of just being what I'd say down the road, a round trip is 75 kilometres for me now. But I still come every day.
So I think I've really made you talk for hours here. You must be exhausted. I was going to just end up with thinking about what's changed. What are the things that you've seen have changed since the services for the, starting with the bus and now ending up with the incorporated organisation. But do you think it's changed, or are the needs still...
Oh, the needs have changed greatly. When we first started, we covered from babies up to older people. Then I spoke about laugh earlier. There was a break in laugh, a split, and we moved some of them up to Casa Paloma, which was a brand new...
I'll just stop for a minute. So this is just starting again. We've had an interruption with some gorgeous tomato crackers. But
with
Jane is
cheese.
With some cheese.
Yeah.
But Jane is just going to summarise what she thinks those changes have been, and then we'll call it a day, I think.
Well, the youth... the laugh became the junction, and we called it the junction because we were fortunate enough to secure a new building at a caravan park that was being built called Casa Paloma. It's gone now, but
where
that's where we started. It was at the junction of Carpasher Road and Camden Valley Way.
Yep.
And so part of it was Camden Council, the other part was Liverpool. From there, we moved out to Austrop. So across from our permanent building for Outer Liverpool Community Service here on Edmondson Avenue, we look onto 11th Avenue. And on 11th Avenue is where the Junction Youth Service, which is now called Junction Work. So the funding department felt that to have two youth services or two services dealing with youth so close together that we relinquished the youth part and the junction was the Junction Youth Service. And so I was the foundation member there too. And so the junction used to use our Realm and Rainbow bus. Oh, I was the driver.
So what
year
was the junction established?
The junction was established in the late 80s.
Yes, when all those little children became teenagers.
Yeah,
and
there was a need in Austral for it. So, and people couldn't understand. I'm also on the Progress Association. I'm on lots of things. I just like all my life, apart from paid work in life, which when you think about it was really just a short time, because when I had the children said when they had finished their school in university, then I'd find a paid job. But I did all kinds of things, especially for Outer Liverpool Community Service. But I learned to divorce myself from different organisations. So at the junction, I would be the junction, and if we didn't like something about the what's now called Outer Liverpool Community Service, I'd have my say. And likewise, when I'm here, when I'm at the progress meetings, I talk about down the back, the community service down the back. And at first, when people knew that comes to the progress meeting, they look and they go, but Jane, you are out of Liverpool Community Service. And I go, no, I'm out of the Progress Association at the moment. So I've learned to divorce
but
myself.
But they're all integrated.
They're all
they?
Integrated.
Because
they're
you're
different
looking
people.
At this. You've got a sort of a helicopter that is hovering over this community.
Yes.
And you're putting the connections together.
So just summing up, we depend, Outer Liverpool Community Service depends on part funding from the government somehow. We've had up to 12 paid workers in different fields. So we've actually don't do as many things, which is natural because we don't have enough workers. We would have those workers if we could get the money. And there was a time, not all that long ago, that management committee was actually putting their own money in to pay our workers' pay. We just had faith that some politician would come and see what we're doing, because the funding department thought for the amount of money they give us, and then they go by the number of heads that you cater for, not what you do.
No, not the quality of the service.
No, so...
or where the need is.
That's right. So we've done a lot in domestic violence. Now we just refer people. And this area, as you may have already found out, is that people keep their personal lives, their personal details to themselves, especially with the different former Yugoslav ladies. When there was an outbreak of war, we lost quite a number of the Bosnians. The Croats was the main ones, and then a Bosnian stayed in, and then she's got a friend. So, I mean, all that's all over now. They're all just one group again.
And so you have, so the service is flexible to deal with what is important in the community at that time.
That's right. And there's a lot of domestic violence in the area. There is a lot of drugs, but people don't want to talk about it. But when they find out that our staff can help them, they don't have to explain exactly what's going on, just roughly, and they get referred. And all the people with community transport, with the Southwest Community Transport. So they're a referral service as well. But they work very, very hard. We had a children's day here on Saturday that was funded by Liverpool. Liverpool Catholic Club gave us the money to run it. And it was very, very successful. We did not expect very many people here because March has been very wet. It is a lot of work that goes into it. We had one of the directors, George A.K., came out to open it, and he said, put in for it again. We've run it 4 years continuous. There's been breaks where some service club hasn't come forward. But he was so impressed. But as we explained to him, CDSE funding, which is from the poker machines that comes to us, Liverpool councils have a say in getting applications, and we don't fit into what Liverpool Council. It depends on the workers who are at Liverpool Council, what their emphasis is on. So he told us that, put your application in and speak to the secretary for the directors at the Catholic Club. Last year we were told by the director, the president of John Edmondson, who funded us last year, they just said, you know, you're in an outlying area, and we can see how does so few people manage to put on something like this. But I didn't tell them that I was here on the Friday night helping the staff grab it, because I've got more living skills than they have because I've lived longer. And I thought, there's no way we're going to get the rest of the thing. So I set it all up in here, and I put beautiful posters up there, and went home at 3:10, and I misunderstood our coordinator. I thought she said Camden High was coming up with the marquee at 7:00, and it was actually supposed to be 8:00. So I got back here at 6:00 in the morning, wondering where Camden High was with the marquee. So people that know or can see what work is done, we feel very honoured that people do, but there are people who've lived in the area for all their lives, and they'll say, Oaks? What are they? What's that? Never heard of it. This is what they tell the funding department. And then they say, oh, when are you having your jewellery? Say, well, who are we? Oh, well, you run jewellery. You know. So the name doesn't really matter to the community.
We're there for people who need it.
Yeah.
And you've actually, it's interesting, you've gone full circle. A focus on children.
Yes.
And then eyes of people get older. But here you are again running children's festivals.
And we've started our kindy gym up again.
So
we go around in circles,
which is what it should be like.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jane. I'm sure there's more. Therese will probably say, keep those tapes going. You're going to have to come back and do some more talking.
No.
But I think we've captured so much information. It's fantastic. And what a local treasure. Thank you.